Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Show's packed today. And I always say that, and it's always true, and today it's especially true. It's very packed. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Dr. Victor J. Stenger. Dr. Stenger's a physicist, and he's the author of God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, The Story of a Triumphant Idea. And in this book, Dr. Stenger makes the case that in the final analysis, atoms and the void are all that exists. So you don't want to miss this one. All right. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Gregory Koger, who we talked to a little while ago after he had been arrested and was facing charges basically for filming a statement against censorship at the Ethical Humanist Society in Chicago in 2009. And Gregory's a former prisoner who spent 6 years in solitary and is now being ordered to finish his sentence of 300 days for filming that statement. And we're going to be talking with Gregory about torture and the prison hunger strike. And we're also going to be joined by someone who has been working with Gregory around this in Chicago. His name is Dr. Antonio Martinez. And Dr. Martinez is a psychologist with the Institute for Survivors of Human Rights Abuse and a co-founder of the Marjorie Koehler Center for the Treatment of Survivors of Torture. Gregory, Dr. Martinez, welcome to the show.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, well, let's jump into this because this is just one of the most urgent questions that's facing people here and people all over the world, really, when you think about it. And this prisoner hunger strike, which began with about 30,000 prisoners in the California state prison system, and now there are thousands remaining on strike. And it's also been the target of very severe repression by the state, including the removal of 14 of the leading people in the strike, removing them to an even more stringent, even more restricted solitary confinement, and also seizing a lot of their belongings, including things that they've written, things that they were proposing, you know, materials that they were using to try and figure out how to lead this strike. So that's all happened over the last couple of days. Now, Gregory, you spent over 6 years in solitary confinement yourself as a teenager sentenced to an adult maximum security prison, and you've described yourself as a survivor of torture. And I think that kind of blows people's minds when they hear that. Explain what you mean there.
Well, first of all, I think the international community is extremely clear on the fact that solitary confinement is torture. The conditions that over 80,000 prisoners in the United States who are in varying forms of isolation and solitary confinement meets the international definition of torture. One way that I have tried to kind of convey what that experience is like is to ask people to think about locking yourself in your bathroom for a year or 5 years or 10 years. You don't have any human contact. You're given your food through a slot in the door. You might get a few pieces of mail. You might have a TV or you might not. One brother who I read about in an article, he was sent to segregation and isolation. He had a TV. He's like, oh, man, this ain't going to be nothing. You know, I'll do this like it ain't nothing. He watched the TV, and within a month, he thought the TV, people on the TV were talking to him. He unplugged the TV, put it under his bunk, and never watched it again. There's a brother in Pelican Bay who's one of the leaders of the hunger strike, as you alluded to, who the officials of the California Department of Corrections have now put into even more restrictive conditions, very explicitly because they are stepping forward in political resistance to the torture they're facing, who said in 28 years he has seen the sun four times. There are prisoners in Angola. Herman Wallace was a Black Panther and was falsely charged with several other Black Panther prison leaders there for allegedly being involved in killing a prison guard. He has been in solitary confinement for 40 years. There is no other nation on earth who uses long-term solitary confinement, period, much less to the extent that the United States does.
Dr. Martinez, now you're somebody who's dedicated your life to working with people who've survived torture. And in relation to this use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, this method of torture, you've argued that not only that it is torture, but you also say that what you hear, you said, what I hear is very similar to what I hear about torture chambers in Guatemala, in Colombia, in Chile. And you say, actually, in Chile, Pinochet was more human. Let's talk about what you were saying there.
Yes, solitary confinement is torture. It has been declared so by the United Nations. Beyond 2 weeks, it begins to really change the makeup of the person, their personality. Dr. Gracian, that studied this situation very profoundly, defined the syndrome of solitary confinement as difficulty thinking, concentration, lack of memory, disorientation, paranoid thinking. What it really struck me is that the correctional system in the United States says about rehabilitation, and they are doing exactly the contrary. Solitary confinement produces aggression. Human contact is not a privilege that you can play with it. Human contact is the basis for life. It's as basic as air. It's like saying, you broke your leg, I'm going to rehabilitate you, help you to rehabilitate, and what you do instead is cutting both legs. It's similar to that. It's totally out of the question. Also, one thing that is important to note is that the severity of the crime doesn't have anything to do if you finish in solitary confinement. It's the conduct in prison. And there's no studies about the interactional aspect of this conduct in prison. We have in solitary confinement people interacting only with one guard, and nobody supervising this guard, not knowing what kind of trigger they're pushing to get reactions, and then the person, of course, get more solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is torture. Pinochet permitted in his concentration camp people to talk, people to have music. It was, in that sense, more human than what's happening right now.
You know, I think that's something that really shocks quite a few people. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gregory Koger. Gregory's a former prisoner who spent 6 years in solitary and is now facing 300 days for filming a statement against censorship at a public meeting of the Ethical Humanist Society of Chicago in 2009. And Dr. Martinez is a psychologist with the Institute for Survivors of Human Rights Abuse and co-founder of the Marjorie Kovler Center for the Treatment of Survivors of Torture. And I should also mention that Gregory is also a revolutionary activist, which leads me to this next question. I think, Dr. Martinez, maybe if you speak to this first, and then I'll have Gregory speak to it as well. You spoke about the political context of the use of torture. You made a big point about you can't look at torture outside of the political context of that. Can you explain what you meant?
Of course, torture is a mechanism of control. It's designed to break the personality. It's not for getting information. It's to put you in your place, to tell you if you get involved in your own agenda, in collective agenda to help people, and you step in our toes, we will torture so that we will control you. It's about control. It's not about getting information.
Now, you also said there's the point about using that as a tool of repression, somewhat specifically, as well as, you know, there's a broader impact on society as a whole. And I was fascinated by the thing that you talked about, friendly fascism, and how that's related to this whole question of torture and how it's perceived in the society.
Yes, of course. It just creates a society of interaction of terror. There's a very important sociologist called Amit Sioni that he defined what is a dead society. And a dead society is one where the system has to put one policeman for almost every citizen, where you are watched all the time, where you don't have any kind of existing freedom. And this is where we are going towards, to democracy, to some sectors of the population, and to a kind of oppressive, almost dictatorship to minorities. Poor people and minorities are the majority in this country. It's obviously a tool for putting people in their place and not letting them have their own voice.
Gregory, the same questions to you. You know, in particular, this question about the political context for the use of torture.
Look, mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow, of which solitary confinement is a subset, was specifically brought in through both the conscious workings of the rulers of this system and the internal dynamics of capitalism and imperialism. The rulers of this system saw what happened in the 1960s. They saw a revolutionary upsurge where people from many different backgrounds, but in particular black folks, were stepping forward, you know, and actually about changing the world. We saw this happen in an international context where you had liberation struggles throughout the world, not least of which where you actually had a socialist country under Mao in China that was a beacon for the entire world and radiating revolution and an alternative future of socialism and communism and the liberation of all humanity. So the rulers of this system were very aware of the revolutionary potential of the people, which is unfortunately sometimes we don't even recognize our own potential. And in response to that, they brought in this entire system of mass incarceration, which is very much designed to crush any potential revolutionary movement from developing in this country. And it's also a response to the fact that from the beginnings of this country, which is founded in genocide of the native peoples and slavery, bringing millions of Africans here in chains, that this country has no future for black folks in particular. After the Civil War, there was sharecropping. Now we have the new Jim Crow, where there is no use for these people. The system has shipped out the jobs that were in the inner cities, where after the Great Migration, a lot of black folks trying both to get a better life for their family, as well as escape from the crushing racism of the South, came to the North to get jobs in factories. Those are all gone. They've been shipped out to other countries where the rulers of this system and the capitalists feel that they can exploit other people even more profitably than they could exploit people here. So we have several generations of youth who this system has absolutely no future for. And we have a cradle-to-prison pipeline. I saw recently a quote from a youth who had seen the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, where he said something along the lines of, look, I know I was convicted before birth. You know what I'm saying? This system has already labeled me a criminal with no future but to go to prison, period. We saw what happened with Trayvon, and if my voice is a little bit messed up, it's because I've been in the streets every day almost since before that verdict came down, mobilizing people to oppose this modern-day lynching. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the California prison hunger strike and prison and torture in prison. And we're talking with Gregory Koger, who is a revolutionary activist. He's part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's also a former prisoner who spent 6 years in solitary and is now facing the finishing of a 300-day sentence for filming a statement against censorship at a public meeting of the Ethical Humanist Society of Chicago in 2009. And Dr. Antonio Martinez. And Dr. Martinez is a psychologist with the Institute for the Survivors of Human Rights Abuse and co-founder of the Marjorie Kovler Center for the Treatment of Survivors of Torture. Now, Dr. Martinez, I want to follow up on a little bit with both of you on what we've just been talking about. And in particular, you know, there is this thing of like, okay, the political context of torture and the use of torture and how it actually impacts broadly throughout society. But there's also something that's very important in relation to how people, how it conditions people to see each other. And there's a thing where that as long as the torture is being carried out behind bars, behind the prison walls, if people don't see it, how much is that in their minds and how much can be done with people just sort of turning their eyes the other way? And it seems to me that there's really this kind of dual thing going on here where in order for people to live with the knowledge of this happening, there has to be actually some kind of acceptance to a degree of these other people in prison are less than human. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, torture works. Torture works in putting people in their place. A lot of people, part of the nature of torture is it has to be a secret at viva voce, a secret that everybody knows so that it will be able to control more of the population. The idea of torture is to control the population, to let them know people that are not involved politically, they know this will happen if you get involved. So the central question is, do we want to live in this kind of society? There's a possibility of having a different kind of society where everybody can have their voice. And of course, it's possible by organizing. But The importance of torture is to understand that it's a mechanism of controls in the hand of the state, and it works controlling people.
Gregory, how about you in terms of this question of the dehumanization of the people in prison being necessary for the system to be able to carry out this torture with relative, if not acceptance, and just ignoring it on broadly in the population broadly? What do you think about this question of dehumanization? And I'd relate to that, because we are running up on our time, but I'd relate to that the fact that, you know, you've also spoken very movingly about this thing that you were just talking about a little earlier, that related to that dehumanization question and overturning the verdict on the prisoners being not human or other than human is the point about the transformation that many prisoners, including yourself, went through in prison.
Yes, and Dr. Martinez was just alluding to kind of that potential. I do want to briefly read a statement from the hunger strikers talking about this bigger context that they're aware of. We have taken up this hunger strike and work stoppage, which has included 30,000 prisoners in California so far, not only to improve our own conditions, but also as an act of solidarity with all prisoners and all oppressed people around the world. So these prisoners are beginning to see that it's not just about them. You know, and I want to read a quote from Bob Avakian from the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. "Those that this system has cast off, those it has treated as less than human, can be the backbone and driving force of a fight not only to end their own oppression, but to finally end all oppression and emancipate all of humanity," end quote. And look, I lived that life. I was in a street gang. I was in prison when I was 17. I became a revolutionary in solitary confinement, in large part due to receiving Revolution newspaper from the Prisoners' Revolutionary Literature Fund. And I'm very much a part of the movement for revolution because all of these outrages, from the prisoners being tortured to the oppression of women and the acts of revoking their right to birth control and abortion, to the environment, to the murder of Trayvon Martin, to the demonization of immigrants, all of these are integral to the functioning of capitalism and imperialism. And we have a way out of this. Prisoners are taking this up. People on the streets are taking this up. There's a movement for revolution, for a totally different world. And I would really encourage people to get up with this revolution, to check out the film that I referenced, B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less, to get with Revolution newspaper and be part of building this movement to not only end the oppression of people in prisons, but all of the oppression of this system, because a radically different world is possible. The world does not have to be this way, and we can change it.
All right, Gregory, and I have one final question for you, and you have about 3 minutes to answer it, a little bit less.
Okay.
You know, you're currently facing an immediate prospect of being sent back to prison to finish this 300-day sentence that we were talking about, and you've said that if you go, you will join the hunger strike. Now, let's talk about why you see this strike as so significant and tell people very briefly what your situation is right now.
Yes. Well, okay. I was arrested for filming a statement against censorship at the Ethical Humanist Society. The entirety of those charges were based on absolute lies from the president and board members of the Ethical Humanist Society to the Skokie police. We have documented recording evidence of them making claims about what happened. There was a video that I took on the day in question. It completely refuted the statements and allegations that the president and the police made. What did the prosecutor do? Throw out the charges? No, she worked with the witnesses to present an entirely different story. The evidence was suppressed by the judge, who aided and abetted this absolute outrage of prosecutorial misconduct, and they convicted me, and I have a 300-day sentence. I am joining the hunger strike not just because they're putting me back in jail, but because I am joining the solidarity with the prisoners. The prisoners have called for a national hunger strike for people across the country, in prison and out, to support them. They are giving me the opportunity to go in and organize with other prisoners, to learn from other prisoners, and to actually bring forward, you know, people who have nothing to lose but their chains as a mighty force for revolution. That is what my life is about. That is what this hunger strike is about. And that is what I'm going to be doing if and when they lock me up, which is extremely likely.
All right, Gregory, we're going to have to close with that. And it's a great note to close on. I want to thank you both for joining us. Gregory, Dr. Martinez, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Gregory Koger and Dr. Antonio Martinez. Gregory is a former prisoner who spent 6 years in solitary and is now facing a return to jail for filming a statement against censorship at a public meeting of the Ethical Humanist Society of Chicago in 2009. Gregory is also a revolutionary activist, and he is a part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Dr. Martinez is a psychologist with the Institute of Survivors of Human Rights Abuse and a co-founder of the Marjorie Cuvler Center for the Treatment of Survivors of Torture. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Victor J. Stenger about his book, God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, the story of a triumphant idea. And this is a story you don't want to miss, because what it says is, all we got out there are atoms and the void. Stay tuned.
Brothers and sisters, have you heard the news? The storm has lifted and there's nothing to lose. So swap your confirmation for your dancing shoes, because there never was no God. Step out of the darkness and onto the streets. Forget about the farce, let's have a carnival feast. Raise up your lowered head and hear the liberation beat, because there never was no God. And there is no God. So clap your hands together. There is no God. No. together. There is no God. So ring that victory bell.
Welcome back. That was Frank Turner with Glory Hallelujah. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. I read his book. I found it really fascinating. And it was challenging in every way I can think of. And I thought, and also very liberating. And his name is Victor J. Stenger. Dr. Stenger is an adjunct professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado and emeritus professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Hawaii. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, God, the Failed Hypothesis, God and the Folly of Faith, and many other books. And he's here to talk with us today about his latest book, God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, The Story of a Triumphant Idea. Dr. Stenger, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. I have to tell you, our show has always put a big emphasis on atheism and really trying to actually talk about the basis for atheism. And your book, God and the Atom, has done quite a bit in terms of shoring that up and making that case to people. So I wanted you to start off by talking about God and the Atom, a brief overview about what the book is about and what you're trying to do with it.
Okay, well, it's basically a history of the idea that the world is nothing but particles of matter and nothing else. Now, I say it's a history. I should emphasize it's not something written by a historian, but it's a scientist's own view based on his past experience and so on. I worked for 37 years in research in elementary particle physics, and also I spent a lot of time on particle astrophysics. I retired in 2000, but have continued to write books on the subject for the general audience. This book is basically takes us from 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece with the people that are known as the atomists. They were the first ones to make the proposal that the world is nothing but atoms in the void. This was Democritus and Leucippus. And I carry on a little bit from them, to Epicurus and so on through the Middle Ages, when atomism was suppressed because it was basically atheistic in philosophy. And it was not surprising that the Catholic Church suppressed it. But then it was rediscovered in the Renaissance period and really formed the basis of the modern scientific revolution. So I follow through on that. And I end up with the most recent confirmation of the whole idea, with the confirmation of the existence of the Higgs boson, which was the last remaining gap that had to be filled with the so-called standard model of elementary particles and forces that was created back in 1970.
Well, let me ask you this. If you're going to write a book about rooting atheism in science and physics, it's a really interesting approach you took, because I don't know how many people would have gone back 2,500 years to talk about the early atomists, you know, and it's kind of remarkable because that was happening where people were arguing for this atomist theory in the absence of any other observation of atoms being possible.
Right. However, it still was based on observations. I think that one of the misconceptions that I try to clear up, and I've seen this in books, and there was even an article in the New York Times that I referred to where the author claims that atomism was just a result of pure thought. He's trying to show that you don't need to always to have experiments and observations to learn about anything. And I dispute that strongly. I show how these ancient atomists were basing their ideas on observations such as dust motes in a sunbeam bouncing around randomly and inferring from that they were being struck by unseen blows from atoms. That was an observation, and they came up with this idea that has really stood the test of time.
One of the things that kind of struck me, too, though, was that there's a point, too, in here that was kind of inspiring for me, because there's a point of you can postulate certain things as theories even before you're able to actually dig in and lay them out in any full form. And a lot of times people will sort of narrow the conception of science or the realm of science in the world by saying, if you can't prove it, you have no right to say it. And these cats were actually sitting there and saying, look, this is what we're seeing, and these are theories that we're advancing. Even though they couldn't really prove it, they could build their arguments and advance these theories, which had, as you point out, a remarkable impact all the way down through history.
Well, science really doesn't involve proof in the sense that we talk about it in logic, for example, logical proof or mathematical proof. Well, of course, science uses such proofs. Science is ultimately based on observation, and the kind of proof that I use when I talk about science, the use of the word proof, is more like the proof you have in the court of law, where you could never be absolutely certain that the defendant is guilty, and you have to rely on guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the kind of proof that I'm talking about here. It's always beyond a reasonable doubt, but nevertheless, you have to always, in science, allow for the possibility that in the future things might change, new ideas might come along, new discoveries might come along. You can never rule that out. So you always keep a little bit of a door open for the alternative explanations.
Yeah, I'm going to get into that with you a little bit later on some of the things that you state towards the end of the book. But let me remind listeners now that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Victor J. Stenger. He's an adjunct professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado, an emeritus professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Hawaii, and we're talking about his book, God and the Atom, from Democritus to the Higgs boson, the story of a triumphant idea. Tell me this. You were just talking about proof and what you need is proof, and also laying open the possibility of new discoveries all the time. It seems every time something is discovered, it opens a door in many ways to not sort of shutting down and saying, okay, this is it. This is all you'll ever need to know. But it actually opens a door for a lot of people to continue investigating in different ways. Now, one of the things you say, though, is you say that the early atomists argued that there's nothing but atoms in the void. And you make a comment there, and you're talking about Epicurus and all these people like that, and you're saying that the atomism of 2,500 years ago was in principle, if not in detail, it was the model of the universe modern science brings us today.
Yes, that's obviously it's not a detail, but the basic notion is quite simple, namely that the universe is just composed of fundamental particles, and they call them atoms, and the things that we call atoms today are no longer the fundamental particles, but that's just a minor point. The basic idea of elementary particles moving around in empty space being all there is. And incidentally, this is another point that I try to make, is that the universe of the ancient atomists was eternal. It had no beginning and no end, and it was infinite. And there could have been many other universes, and that's also the latest thinking of cosmology, that our universe is just one universe in a multiverse. And all these things, of course, affect the whole question of the existence of God or the supernatural of any sort. And so that's basically the theme of the book. While I spend most of my time talking about the science and the history, I do try to work in here and there where religious beliefs come in and show how they're just ruled out at every stage in this development.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you. You know, throughout the history of science or scientific exploration of reality, there seems to have been a constant that is really in the struggle between theists and atheists. And you talk about atomism being anathema to religious belief, and I think that carries out all the way through, down to the current time.
Yes, that's right. No, I have to make one point clear, and that is that these ancient Greeks did not quite say that there were no gods, and I think that was a safe thing for them to do at the time. I think nobody said there were no gods in that sense, but the gods they imagined were made of the same atoms as the rest of us. They were eternal. These atoms are eternal, incidentally, and so they were eternal. And living in a state of perfect happiness, why should they have anything to do with humans? So they didn't create the universe, for one thing. The universe always existed, and they don't participate in human affairs. They don't give a dang about humans, because why would they? They already have a state of perfect bliss. At least that was their concept of God. So I still call that atheism, as far as I'm concerned, because that's not the theism that we understand, where God is the creator, God plays a role in everything that happens in the universe. That's the theism that I'm referring to when I say their view was an atheistic view.
What I was really interested in, too, is that at every step of the way, it seems with each new advance in science and each new slap at the idea of theism, it really developed as a major struggle. I mean, it was a lot of assaults on science, and even to a certain point of really a pushing back of science to a certain extent. Galileo, and who was the man you talked about, too, which always really struck me in other things I read, Bruno?
Yes, Giordano Bruno, who was burned at the stake in 1600.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have to also qualify things by pointing out that probably the greatest scientist of all time was Isaac Newton. You might argue that Darwin was, and Darwin certainly was great, so I won't quibble with you about that. But anyway, Isaac Newton was very much a believer. He was an unconventional believer. He didn't believe in the Trinity. which is kind of amusing because he held the chair, Lucasian chair of, in Trinity College in Cambridge, the same chair that's held today by Stephen Hawking. But he was very much a believer. He spent as much time on studying the Bible and coming up with various predictions based on the Bible. He also spent a lot of time on alchemy, which was a pseudoscience. It eventually grew into chemistry, but at that time it was very supernaturally inclined. And yet he had the idea of particles moving around under forces that Galileo proposed. Incidentally, Galileo was also a believer, but Galileo, among those early believers, was very careful to separate religion from science. But Newton didn't. Newton still brought God into the picture. He couldn't understand why the planets had the particular orbits they did, and so he said, well, God must have made them that way. And it was only till about another generation or two later, with some of the French physicists like Laplace and Lagrange and some of those famous physicists who worked on celestial mechanics and questions of that sort, that they were able to solve some of the problems that Newton said required you to bring God into the picture. So there was always that conflict there. A lot of Christian apologists will tell you today that Christianity had a lot to do with the growth of science, contributed to the growth of science, and I just simply dispute that. I've talked to independent historians that don't have a particular religion to promote, and they say that it's just simply not true. I mean, right from the Dark Ages, the Church fought hard against science, you know, and in particular the critical thinking associated with it. They didn't object to people making observations of the stars and so on that would help them set the date of Easter and things of that sort. There was no objection there, but it was the philosophical interpretation that you drew from scientific discovery that there was no need for a God, that was the thing that they fought tooth and nail. And incidentally, they still do. For example, when the Catholic Church or when moderate Protestants will tell you that they accept evolution, they really don't, because they still say it's God-guided evolution. They will not accept the basic teaching of Darwin that evolution is an accident, that there's no special place for humans in the scheme of things. And so all throughout history, you find that conflict, and it's continued to this day.
Let me remind listeners again that we're talking with Victor J. Stenger, Dr. Stenger, who's the author of God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, The Story of a Triumphant Idea. Now, Dr. Stenger, tell me this, and it's along these same lines, because I was fascinated, too, by the fact that you said that a Catholic priest actually was the first one to develop the theory about the Big Bang. And that was really interesting to me, because that also, in some ways, the church even went up and tried to use that as sort of a justification for their creationist myth. But that was something that really opened things up in science at that time, right?
Yes, I mean, this was Georges Lemaître, a Belgian priest. I think he was even still a postgraduate student when he came up with the idea of the Big Bang. And he also anticipated some of the stuff that Hubble gets credit for, the expansion of the universe. He wrote a paper before Hubble did on that basic subject. So he was a remarkable physicist, and he was a priest. And some people say, well, therefore, that's how he got the idea of the creation. And he may have, but he was a good scientist. And he told the Pope in no uncertain terms, well, you know, I guess you don't tell him, no, he highly recommended to the Pope that he not draw the conclusion from the idea of the Big Bang that, therefore, that was some kind of proof of the existence of God. He said, this is just science. Be careful of how you interpret it. And many people after him have used the argument that the Big Bang is evidence for creation, and it's not. I talk about that in several of my books, how just because our universe began in the Big Bang, that doesn't mean it didn't come from a previous universe. It doesn't mean that there aren't other universes. So, and that certainly doesn't require any miracle that we know of. We have lots of theories and models worked out in mathematical precision of how the universe could have come about naturally. And that's all part of this whole idea that the atomists in ancient times came up with. So it all fits in very well, actually.
Well, let me move into this. I was really impressed by a point that you made in the book about that the scientific revolution was actually really a revolution. I mean, the chaos and what it unleashed. What a lot of people don't recognize, that a lot of times there's you look at the scientific revolution and you think of it in an orderly, you know, in an orderly sense, and it's just sort of progressing from one idea to proving it to then moving on and developing other things. But it actually was a total upheaval. And you make the point, or you quote someone making the point, that it upended everything, that these folks had to actually destroy one world and replace it with another, not just criticize it and change a few things here and there. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I actually quoted some historian, whose name I've forgotten now, as saying just that. So it wasn't my original idea that Galileo, who really triggered the scientific revolution, it wasn't just replacing old ideas with new ideas. He was replacing a whole system of thought. And what that system of thought was based on was the notion that experiment must, and observation must be the final arbiter. Because prior to that, and I also try to make this point, a lot of people tend to think of science on one side and reason on the other. And I point out that the great theologians of the Catholic Church, Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, were very reasonable men. They used logic, but the difference between them and the people after Galileo and Galileo himself was that they said that the scripture and revelation have to come first, and then observation is just helping us to understand better about God's creation, but we don't deny the existence of God or the priority of scripture and revelation over observation. And that was what got turned around 180 degrees by Galileo. Galileo still was a Christian. He still believed in scripture, but he put observation before scripture, before the authority of the church. And of course, that was what he got in trouble about.
Let me remind listeners again that we're talking with Victor J. Stenger, Dr. Stenger, who's the author of God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, The Story of a Triumphant Idea. Well, let's get move into this. And this is really interesting to me, because you say that all we know about is what we observe with our senses and instruments. We describe these with models, sometimes called theories, but we haven't the faintest idea of what is really out there. All we need to concern ourselves with is what we observe. If whatever is really out there produces no observable effect, then why should we worry about it? Let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, I was going to talk about that in relation to the Higgs boson, and I wanted to find out what you thought about the significance of that in relation to that statement. But let's talk about that statement first.
Well, what is it that you quoted me beautifully? Thanks so much. It's pretty clear you did read the book.
That's easy to do, man. It's easy to do. What I was getting at is, because, you know, there was something that you keep mentioning in the book, and you talk about reductionism, and
yes,
you talk about the idea that you know you advocate reductionism. And to me, I was kind of wondering about that, because you link that with this idea of we can break everything down into its component parts, and that's
right.
That's the essence of it. But then you also make a point of that we can't really know what's really out there, which ends up, to me, I'm wondering, how do you know, is that not sort of a little bit of relativism?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm just saying that as far as we know, and again, I have to make it clear that who knows? I mean, someday somebody will find some other thing that works better. But science as we know it, based on observation, is the best thing that we've been able to come up with so far. And it's based on the notion that our observations are our only source of knowledge. That's where we differ. In my previous book, incidentally, which was called God and the Folly of Faith, I get into the difference between religious thinking and scientific thinking. How religious thinking, even though religious thinking allows for observation, it assumes that humans have a special channel to knowledge outside of the realm of observation, and that's the difference between religion and science, which says our only channel to knowledge, as far as we know, because it is through observation, and that's the best we can do. And so I argue that not only is it the best we can do, it's all we can do, and it's all we need to do, because suppose there was something out there, but it had no effect on humans, on the universe in any way, just left us alone. And there are some ideas of God, incidentally, that are just that way. The deist concept that God just created the universe and left it alone. If that's the situation, then that deity produces no observable effects, and so why care? If he had an influence on human life in one way or the other, then that would be an observable effect. But since he doesn't, it doesn't, then there's no reason why we even have to be concerned with it. And that was what I meant by all that.
Okay. All right. That makes a lot of sense to me. Now, and related to that in some ways, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the Higgs boson. And I had somebody on who had been working on that when actually it was confirmed. And it was, you know, just a fantastic day, I think, for anybody who is a thinking individual on the planet. And even for people who didn't know about it, this is a big breakthrough. Let's talk about the significance of the Higgs boson in general, and then in relation to what you're trying to do with this book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the Higgs boson was the final confirmation of the validity of the standard model of elementary particles that was developed in the 1970s. And that's, I spent my research career working on elementary particle physics. I started at UCLA as a graduate student, graduated there in 1963 and continued on University of Hawaii, and was one of the thousands of physicists worldwide who helped make the observations that led to this standard model. And when it was developed in the 1970s, it basically was agreed with all the existing data, and it continued to agree with all the existing data, right on up to and including so far everything that's come from the Large Hadron Collider. And the only thing missing was there was no observation of this particle that was required in the standard model, and that was the Higgs particle, which is the particle that gives the other particles mass, and that showed up with exactly the properties as predicted. Since a year has gone by, almost, since that discovery, and they've made lots more observations, and they've just tended to confirm that. At the same time, I have to say something. I don't remember now whether I even talked about this in the book, because it may represent my more recent thinking. But so far, they haven't found evidence for anything else. They expected to find other particles by now, and they haven't. And this is causing people a lot of consternation, because they were hoping to have hints of where we're going to go next after the standard model. And I find the whole thing actually quite exciting. I'm not concerned about it at all, because it means that a lot of the speculations that people have been making for the last 30 or 40 years, like string theory and supersymmetry, may turn out to be wrong. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be refuted by the data, and I find that, since I was not a theoretical physicist, but I was an experimental physicist, I feel that kind of appealing to me to see the experiment again be the final arbiter rather than theoretical speculation.
And actually, that has to do with something you said in the book that I was really also very impressed with, which was you made a point about, and I can't remember the exact first part of it, but you made a point about how while we can't really know what really is out there, that actually with science, there's nothing standing in the way of constantly exploring for that. And actually, if something happens and something like even getting the Higgs boson, even if it had turned out that they weren't able to actually confirm that that existed, then the idea would have been, okay, other doors would then be opened up, that you'd have to actually continue searching, not turn around and saying, oh, well, let's close down and go to church.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a no-lose situation, because if you find something that confirms your existing theories, that's a win. If you find something that falsifies an existing theory, that's a win too, because now you have a more enjoyable situation, because now you have all kinds of inducement to go further and find out what theory works better. And remember, these are all just models that the humans invent. I don't assign them any particular one-to-one connection with reality, as I said, because you can't really know what it is anyway, what's out there. So these are our models that describe the universe, and that's all we need, because that's all we have to do to put them to use.
Let me remind listeners again that we're talking with Victor J. Stenger, Dr. Stenger, who's the author of God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, The Story of a Triumphant Idea. Now, tell me this. You just said this comment, and I'd really like to, you know, explore it a little bit more. And I've been trying to get at that, the point about saying that you can't really know what's out there anyway, or know what's really out there anyway. Why not?
if what was out there was observable, then it wouldn't be out there. It would be part of physics, all right? So I define, when I say out there, I mean beyond observation, something that we have no way of ever learning about by observation alone. And that's, of course, where the religion comes in. The religion says that we have other channels to knowledge. We have access to out there. We have the scriptures, and we have the revelations of the great religious leaders, and then we also have mystical experiences. People go into have some trance, and then they come back with some, all this knowledge. And near-death experiences, for example, where people come back absolutely convinced that they were in heaven and came back after because they met Jesus, and Jesus sent them back to live out the rest of their lives, and so they're absolutely convinced that there is a heaven. And of course, the books that people write about that are always number one on the bestseller list. And when one disappears from the list, another one appears, all about how near-death experiences have provided proof of heaven. Well, you know, there's an easy way to test that. Ask these people what they learned that they didn't know before, and show us how that could be tested. I don't see any reason why it can't, in principle, be done. You can come back with some prediction of some future catastrophe. You could say Jesus told me that there was going to be an earthquake in Los Angeles. Okay, there's going to be an earthquake. That's not much
easy.
Of a prediction, but give a specific date for it, 20 years in the future or something, and then it happens. Well, you know darn well that couldn't have been a scientific prediction. We're not capable of doing that. So that would have been evidence for a true communication beyond the observable universe, but that hasn't happened. No one has ever come back with anything that they could verify in that rational way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I'm convinced that if I ever hear "walk towards the light," it's got to be my wife or a friend telling me to wake up, wake up. That's the end of it. "Walk towards the light." Yes. Okay. You know, but one of the things that this brings up, something that and we're moving towards a close, but I have just a couple more questions. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, you know, you mention, and I think rightfully with a good amount of annoyance, the idea that, like, for instance, quantum mechanics and you know, and often advances in science are used by New Agers and other religious people to launch an all-out assault on materialism, which is just rampant today. You know, it's like, it's incredible. Even with the Higgs boson, where they were talking about, you know, and I know the scientists didn't do this, but there's a way it was that the significance of it was undercut by the naming of it as the God particle. You know, there's this whole way to kind of undercut scientific advances, and then things, and it's not like some nefarious plot on one level. Maybe there is some, but there's not necessarily that. It's a lot of like the pull, and I kept thinking about, you know, in any kind of when we were talking about how the scientific revolution was an actual revolution, you know, I keep thinking even in social revolutions, the idea that the framework that you exist in currently, whatever you're living in, is an awful hard framework to break out of, because this is what people are trained to see as their horizon. This is what they're trained to see is the only way things can be. And it seems that keeps pulling at us as we make these scientific advances, and you get this unleashing of the wackiest stuff off of scientific advances.
Well, you know, I've written a bunch of books on that, too. I've written two books just on what I call quantum mysticism, the unconscious quantum, and then also one called quantum gods. And, I study what people write, read what people write, and I apply my knowledge to it, and I think I can show that they're mistaken in their claims, that they're misinterpreting what quantum mechanics and what the rest of physics is really saying. You know, physics is hard. It's difficult, and for people without any training in physics, to then pick up what a few popular authors write and transform it into something mystical, there's no basis. I mean, they have no right to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree 100%. Which brings me to this other thing. A big question that people always pose to you is, not to you, but to one who is an atheist or arguing for atheism or arguing for science, they always pose this thing as, really? Well, you can't get something from nothing. You can't get life from non-life.
Yeah, well, you see, that's another thing I've written a lot about. And I realized after trying to explain how you can get something from nothing, I realized the problem was that nothing is very difficult to define. If you try to define something as nothing, then isn't it something? Because then it has some, you have to give it some property, and if something has a property, it's not nothing anymore. So I finally realized that I'm wasting my breath trying to explain how you got something for nothing, since the universe is eternal anyway. Since it didn't have a beginning, it didn't have to come from anything. And that's the way I answer that question. That's what I tell atheists to say, because I know they get that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets it. Like I usually say to them, look, when you have arguments with believers and you skillfully demolish every argument they have for the existence of God, they always come up with this last one that they think is the killer argument, namely, how could you get something from nothing? Well, the answer is, you don't. Have to, the universe always was, and so it didn't have to come from anything. And that's a simple answer, and those of you who are listening, I hope you try using that and see how it works.
I certainly will, and I'll let you know, all right?
Okay.
One last question. This is a chance to get a little poetic. What is it that science, in your mind, what is it, after all that you've been through, all of your own work, what is it that you can say to people that science really does tell us about reality?
Well, it doesn't tell us anything about reality. It just tells us about us and the world we see around us. And that's certainly some aspect of reality, but it doesn't tell us what the total reality is. And I don't know any way of finding that out.
It would certainly be boring as hell if it did give all the answers and there was nothing left for us to do but sit around and get bored.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe someday somebody will come up with a way to access this reality beyond the senses, but no one has yet. That's the message.
But the one thing that it does do is it argues, as you close your book out, with no higher power, which I think is extremely important.
Yep. No sign of it anyway.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Very enjoyable discussion.
Yeah, I agree. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Dr. Victor J. Stenger, who's the author of God and the Atom, From Democritus to the Higgs Boson, The Story of a Triumphant Idea. Well, that brings us to the end of another show. And before we go out, there's a couple of things I want to talk about. One is, very importantly, people need to keep their eyes and ears open, especially around what's happening with the Trayvon Martin case. This verdict cannot be allowed to stay. It must not be allowed to stay. We can't allow it to stand the way it is, all right? This is a slap in the face. It's more than a slap in the face. It's putting a target on the back of every Black and Latino youth in this country, all right? So I think that people need to really pay their attention to that and stand up and make your voices heard around it. And I also want to call on people to pay close attention to what's going on with the California prisoner hunger strike. This is an extremely important development in this society. It's a group of prisoners, the bottom of the bottom, all right? The people who have stood up in the dankest of conditions, the darkest of conditions, those deep dungeons of isolation, despair, and torture. And they stood up and said, we refuse to bow our heads. We refuse to be treated like we're some kind of animals. We are human beings and we demand to be treated as such. And they have very, very importantly made it clear that they are not doing it just for themselves, but for all those who come behind them and for the oppressed of the whole world. And for that kind of outlook, they have undergone all kinds of really harsh repression. As the strike began, they were shown films that showed them how they're going to die if they continue to refuse food. They've been the leaders of the strike have been removed to even deeper isolation units in even deeper solitary confinement as punishment for their role in the strike. And in the face of all this, we need to have their back. All right, so let's not ever forget that. All right. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my intern production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Federico Garcia, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. If you want to follow me, you can do so on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to just, you know, throw in your comments, your ideas, see what we got to say, see what's going on in between shows, check out michaelslate.wordpress.com. All right. That's my blog. You can go there and throw down in any way you want, all right? So this really does bring us to the end of the show, and I want to let you know that I am looking forward to talking to you again next week, so make your way on back here next week. And we're going to go out now with the rest of Frank Turner's Glory Hallelujah. Sing along, enjoy. Talk to you again next week.
Cowering in the dark before some overbearing priest. No waiting until we die, until we restitute the meek. Blaming all our failings on imaginary beasts, because the devil was no god. The fighting of a land your distant fathers told you of, no spilling blood of those who never spread a drop of love. The finger pointing justified by phantoms up above, because the devil was no god. My sins away, but now we're singing my refrain, and this is what I say the devil was no god. There is no god, so clap your hands together. There is no god, no heaven and no hell, but there is no god. We're all in this together. There is no god, so ring that victory bell.